Chapter 8, Revelations, 1985 to 1991. A quote from Francis Galton. Men who leave their mark on the world are very often those who, being gifted and full of nervous power, are at the same time haunted and driven by a dominant idea, and are therefore within a measurable distance of insanity. A Dangerous Winter. Beginning the previous fall, I had a new health aide, whom I will call Joe. He was very relaxed most of the time, and we got along very well. His three-legged dog, Gandhi, was much like his master in that the dog would eat anything that looked like a pill. Joe frequently did not show up on time, I suppose due to his vast consumption of weed, but I was a forgiving sort. He lived with his masochistic girlfriend a few miles out of town in a rented house. It was quite roomy, until they lived there a while and the kitchen completely filled with garbage bags of trash. Joe was an electric bass player and practiced by putting on a cassette of the music, then taking a nap in front of the speakers. No matter what combination of substances was coursing through his brain, he remained an excellent driver. This was important, since I relied on my health aid for my automotive needs. Joe and another friend were part of what I wanted to be a team in growing the mushrooms. I needed help with the labor and expense, and we would split the crop three ways. However, I was the only one who learned the skills, did almost all the work, took most of the risk, and invested all the money. This was not the business plan I had anticipated, but that's what happened. Joe's big garage had a tornado cellar that looked perfect for mushrooms. I assumed that my closet would be most practical for now, but preparing for the future, we built shelves in the cellar and put in lights. This turned out to be a very good move. My eyes started hurting, and when the pain became severe, I went to an ophthalmologist. I had iritis, which is a kind of arthritic inflammation of the iris and other tissues that leaves damage after each episode. Iritis is common among people who have ankylosing spondylitis, and Dad suffered from it in earlier years. I could control it with cortisone drops and dark glasses, and after a few weeks I was mostly recovered. I continued to have periodic attacks from then on, especially during times of stress. In January 1985, Anton came through Denton with a friend from Waitsfield, Vermont, named Montgomery. This character had been in the employ of the State Department in Lebanon, among other adventures, but had become an advisor to Yasser Arafat when this was not exactly popular. Thus, he was fired and concentrated on the hash crop in the Bekaa Valley. Not all his stories were credible, but the ones where people were shooting at him rang true. I came to regret their poor aim. Montgomery was an alcoholic who could not hold his liquor, which did not help him blend into the scene in Lebanon. It wasn't a big hit with me and Denton, either. He had been involved with Anton in failed gold mine speculations some time previously. He asked if I had any weed, and although I hadn't smoked for years, I had a spare joint stored in my freezer in case such was needed for hospitality. A few tokes and he was out like a light, which I preferred. As Anton was such a close friend, I showed him and, sadly, Montgomery as well, my setup for growing mushrooms. By this time, I was ready to set up my first crop. After an overnight visit, they went on to parts west. In February, I got a call from Montgomery saying he was coming through my area on his way back to Vermont, and could he stop by with a business proposition? I said, okay, so shortly thereafter, he showed up at the bus station. Turns out the proposition was for multi-ton hash smuggling from Lebanon to the Balearic Islands off Spain, which did not interest me in the slightest. Now, Doc Humes was not the only friend of Anton's with serious problems. Pretty much all of his friends were trouble, which made me wonder about my own self. Was I the only non-psychotic person he knew? Anyway, I was all about being hospitable, and this was a friend of my best friend's, so... After a couple of days, I told him to please not throw up in my wastebaskets. That's what the toilet is for, thank you very much. I lived not far from a pizza joint, and he phoned in orders and didn't pick them up, so that he could find the pizzas in the dumpsters afterwards. He was gone most of the time and out of my hair, and got a job at a local stable training horses, so things went relatively smoothly for a month. One day he rode up on a huge motorcycle he said a fellow had given him, and stored it on the porch. I realized much later this had to be stolen, but I was a trusting sort, and he was taking care of his own transportation needs. Mushroom growing starts with a psilocybe cubensis spore print, which is entirely legal and available through the mail. I germinated the spores on sterile agar in petri dishes, separated pure strains, and inoculated 2-quart mason jars full of cooked sorghum. The mycelium is the underground part of the fungus, and it grew through the grain until the jars turned white, unless they were contaminated. In that case, it was much like cooking a nice lunch and letting it decay on a warm, moist shelf for a month. I have tried to block out memories of cleaning rotten grain from jars. Surely one of the jobs described by Dante for exceptional sinners. But the mushroom itself was a magical creature for whom I had tremendous affection. It had a clean, fresh smell and was phenomenally beautiful to watch grow. I'd fallen in love with a particularly amazing fungus. The psilocybin was just a bonus. Once the grain jars were fully colonized, I extracted the results and spread it through small bales of pasteurized hay held in special plastic bags. When the straw was completely filled with mycelium, I opened the tops of the bags and added a thin layer of sterilized casing to simulate soil. Then it was time to start cycling the lights and wait for the mushrooms to sprout. I had finished this final preparation in March, when there was a big party out a few miles into the countryside at a friend's home. Montgomery and I got a ride to the party. I sat in the front with 2 women who were sisters, and Montgomery sat in back with 2 of their children, including a 9-year-old girl. After the party had gone on a while, the sisters asked to see me in a separate room and said that my friend had tried to molest the girl. I was horrified and said anything they wanted to do in response was fine with me, and I would kick him out of my house right away. I didn't realize that he had stolen my modest stash of 14 hits of Microdot LSD from my freezer and probably had eaten who knows how many of them, plus drunk a lot of whiskey, plus anything else he could get. Meanwhile, Montgomery was annoyed that a local biker was playing music too loudly for his taste from a car parked in the front yard. He went out and said to turn it down or he'd kill the biker, since he was a tough guy from Vermont. The biker looked calmly at my friends to see what an acceptable response should be, which is to say, how much should he hurt the little punk, whom he outweighed by at least 100 pounds. Fatal or non-fatal? Gun, knife, or stomp? My friends indicated that Montgomery wasn't worth the trouble, and the biker blew it off. When we got home in the early morning hours, I was furious and told Montgomery as calmly as I could that he had to leave. I didn't care where he went, but this was it. He then went psycho and backed me up against a wall, threatening to kill me that night. After quite a bit of jawing, I talked him down enough so that he didn't attack me, but he did sleep as before in my living room. The next day, he moved his stuff to the front porch of the house next door, also owned by my landlord and without a tenant at the time. He threatened to tell the cops about my mushroom closet and acid dealing if I reported his various crimes. From now on, our conversations were shouted through my locked door. He never did quite understand where he was or how my friends would treat him should I come to harm. I recall once the police telling the host of our party, "Don't shoot anybody for a week." This was clearly an emergency. Joe came over, and by stuffing his car full for 3 loads, my apartment became nominally legal. The straw bales were now set up in the tornado cellar. I gathered my courage and called up the detective who had done such a good job when I was mugged. He came over, and I told him as much as I could about Montgomery without incriminating myself. I added that Montgomery was liable to tell him stories about me, that I led a private and peaceful life and was obviously not a criminal. The detective said not to worry. They were interested in actual offenders, and they wouldn't pay any attention to what he said about me. They were disinclined to let a thief and child molester disturb the domestic tranquility that I had done nothing to harm. And true enough, they rounded him up that day and put him on a bus back to Vermont, easiest way to deal with him. This was the only practical solution, as my friends were not in the mood to press charges. Montgomery would not be missed. I contacted Anton and expressed my severe displeasure to him and insisted that he pay for what Montgomery had stolen from me. He sent a check for $300 sometime later. After returning to Vermont, Montgomery borrowed a car from Anton and refused to give it back. I become automobilized for the harvest. With my beloved mushrooms now 10 miles away, I needed wheels. My acid trade had slowly increased over the months, so I could afford the cheapest possible car. I asked around, and a friend had a 1962 Volkswagen Beetle for sale, only $300. A previous conflagration had destroyed the firewall in front of the engine, as well as all the interior fabric and most of the exterior paint. The color was now from rust. Having no firewall made the car exceptionally loud, and I drove with earphones to block the noise. There was no heater, which usually isn't a problem in Texas, except when the blue northers blow down from Canada. The gas gauge didn't work either, so I used a wooden dowel as a dipstick. There was a shade tree mechanic living only a few blocks away who specialized in VWs, and I drove the car across town to his place for inspection and diagnosis. It was hard to start and ran very rough, but managed to get there. Turns out 2 of the 4 cylinders were wired in the wrong order. Once everything was working properly, I installed the top of a baseball trophy on the hood. I traveled in style. Shortly thereafter, the mushrooms sprouted, and we harvested about 3 pounds after drying. My pound just covered the cost of my investment, while my partners had pure profit. Growing mushrooms on straw was slow and took a lot of physical labor that I was doing almost entirely alone. I was pondering other, more advanced, technologically challenging methods. The mycelium is just as psychoactive as the fruiting body, but when grown on solid substrates, it cannot be separated very well. However, some growers had used liquid cultures with good results, typically in very small batches. I hit the library and did months of study on aerobic fermentation and decided to give it a try. Fermenters are sterilized tanks that are vigorously stirred and have a steady stream of filtered air flowing through a nutrient liquid. The control of temperature, acidity, foam, and above all, contamination, results in fermenters being extremely expensive and sophisticated machines. This is a good thing because in addition to making vaccines and antibiotics, the ability to culture mass quantities of bacteria or fungi is a fundamental requirement for biological warfare. If I could make a reliable fermenter of decent size, I could have a harvest every week, freeze-dry the mycelium, and have a reliable organic product of high quality. In addition, the same fermenter could grow a number of molds that produced lysergic acid compounds. So I started experimenting with 2-quart bubble jars, making my own submicron air filters, and powering the lot with a stack of aquarium pumps. To control the temperature and keep things hidden, I bought 2 small refrigerators and persuaded my infrequent visitors to pay no attention to them as they hummed and vibrated. After considerable experimentation, I was able to culture the mushroom in the shape of 1/2-inch balls of mycelium in liquid broth made mostly of barley malt. However, to do this without bacterial contamination required an acidic pH of about 4, which destroyed the psilocybin. Assuming I'd figure out a fix to this, I went shopping for my monster tank. Joe and I went down to the local junkyard, where the attendant in charge was a woman I knew from the 2nd violin section of the school orchestra. I said, "I need a stainless steel tank, kind of like that one over there, about yay high and yay wide, like that tank over there, and say, let's go take a look at that tank over there. Turns out, this was a laboratory-scale spray dehydrator sold for the price of stainless scrap. It cost $80. This beauty could hold 80 gallons of nutrient and might produce a pound of dried mycelium a week, or, if used for lysergic acid amides, enough to supply all the labs in the world with raw material for LSD. Not that this was a practical goal, but it was food for thought. In other news, Susan Fleet lived in a little house across from Flo Hospital with her rambunctious 3-year-old son. She was great with child as a result of a party where she met a barefoot lad from East Texas where the pine cones grow big. He came through town to say howdy once, so I got to meet him. No shoes, but at least most of his teeth. Why didn't I get invited to parties like that? When the time to deliver came in early April, she was a bit out of pocket on a rural highway near the Oklahoma border. She gave birth in her car under the stars of the prairie sky, thankfully with assistance from Bacchus and a midwife. While certain that the middle name would be Jacob, she hadn't decided on a first name and continued to be indecisive for 3 more weeks. Several of us volunteered names for baby XJ Fleet. I insisted that the only appropriate choice for a baby hatched in a hatchback was Otto. I was outvoted. I spent the first week of July at the Rainbow Gathering in Missouri, along with most of the local hippies, soaking up the love and gentle anarchy, and testing the limits of K and LSD combined with living in a tent and using slit latrines. Rose was there with several friends who did not like me because I didn't give them lots of free acid without them asking. They could have had all they could possibly use for only $1 a hit. I was becoming acquainted with drainbows. Several from the Rainbow Gathering later came to Rainbow Valley. For about a week it was, "Hey, brother, got a beer?" And the answer became, "The store is 5 miles that way." They left town. On my return, I set to work on hundreds of technical details for the fermenter. I had the cover story of brewing beer, which was faintly believable, and everything was looking fine, until Joe, out of the blue, freaked out. He couldn't stand my coming to the garage every day and working long hours when he wanted to snooze. He told me I couldn't come to his place anymore, and I got another health aid. Everything ended just like that. Just as well as I was financing the mushrooms by selling acid in order to finance my oracle, which I hadn't been able to start constructing because I'd been growing mushrooms. It was good to be rid of Joe. A couple of months later, at about midnight, I got a knock on the door. I got out of bed, and it was his girlfriend, needing a place to stay for the night. She turned around and waved, headlights blinked, and a car drove off. She'd gotten a ride with the police, from a bar to my house. Joe had hit her and doused her with beer, and she didn't want to go home that evening. I told her it wasn't a great idea to bring official attention to me, what with the hundreds of hits of acid I had on hand, but she assured me that she told the cops I was a very nice guy. Well, I'm sure they thought so anyway, but still. Later, she found another man who dominated her the way she liked and married him. In late August, I went up to visit Dad, and we went to Ferry Beach for a week. Mom and Burns were in charge of the music that summer. I used Burns' violin, and with quite a bit of padding to keep it under my neck, performed a little, but it was painful. Also, I worked up the middle movement of my piano sonata and performed it as well, which was the only time I've played piano in public since age 5. If memory serves, I had dropped by Anton's parents' house, where he was living upstairs. He borrowed $50 to make a down payment on an elderly Jaguar, which he promptly forgot about repaying. I thought this a bit odd, since he was involved in international banking schemes that kept him on the phone at all hours and unable to leave his room for days at a time. From music to Oracle. When the fall semester started, I got together with Dan Hurley and the Zebras for a read-through of the first book of the now-completed Art of the Synthesizer. Although it went pretty well, I knew that 2 of the 5 keyboardists didn't have the classical training required, so they simply could not perform the piece. Dan sequenced 4 of the Goldbug variations on his computer and synthesizer and performed the recording on his faculty recital in October, but the results were predictably mechanical and quickly forgotten. I continued to give Dan scores for 5 synths, including arrangements of my orchestral works, and put in about 2.5 years of work into this format, but nothing was ever performed. His players simply couldn't handle it. In October, I decided to suspend music and work full-time on the Oracle. I couldn't possibly do this large project entirely in my home, so I looked for extra space. When I'd first lived in Denton in the 1950s, our family knew a fellow named Richard Earnhardt, who was very active in the Unitarian Church, mostly to wolf down the food at potlucks. When I was a small lad, he'd gotten in trouble for severely beating his girlfriend, and since then had been on disability pay for mental illness. He was now in his early 60s and living with his aged mother on Fry Street, very near Flow Hospital, next door to where I had formerly lived. From time to time, he would stumble into the local coffee shop, wearing an ancient sweater, holding a poster of Raquel Welch that he had slobbered over, and leer at the college girls. Just the kind of guy I was looking for to help house my secret project in transcendental physics. Who would suspect? He had a garage and a spare room in the back of the house. I went and talked to him about renting both for my project, and he and his mother agreed to a most reasonable sum. First job was to clear out a space in the spare room. I noticed that the several semi-feral cats roaming the property used a litter box, which had not been emptied in a very long time. This was intolerable, so I put the box outdoors. Mistake. The cats were used to defecating in that spot, box or no, and continued to do so. Cat piss had already soaked into the floorboards, but now there was a fresh supply. I had to put the box back. There were 2 major components in the Oracle that were the major technical challenges. One was the Orgon box. This time I made the 8 triangular faces, 8 feet on a side, of plywood. I did the layering in my bedroom with 72 layers of aluminum foil, each separated by 2 layers of newsprint. Once all 8 sides were done, I took them down to the garage and assembled them. 1 corner of one side had a triangular hatch so I could get inside. Eventually, I would have to put the antenna in a dome. Next came the optical resonator. I had a specialist in gem faceting cut a 1-inch diameter flawless quartz crystal with 144 symmetrical facets. Each one of these facets had a corresponding mirror facing it that mounted on a rod to adjust the distance. The crystal was in the center of an acrylic sphere 16 inches across, which in turn rested on a vibration-free mounting. My first method of mounting the crystal used tungsten filaments from light bulbs and was exceptionally sensitive to any motion. I bounced a laser beam off one of the facets that went to a dual-axis diode, allowing me to measure rotation down to a millionth of a radian on my oscilloscope. I had the whole thing floating on four half-filled truck inner tubes, but this was inadequate. Any motion would move the floor and set the crystal to vibrate. I bought a small metal building and put it up next to the house, which got me away from the cat piss. There, I could mount the sphere via the inner tubes directly on the ground. Now I was down to a little seismic background and tremors from traffic. My sensitive electronics were picking up stray signals from the hospital next door. I'd need a more remote location. The main house was in very bad repair, as neither Richard nor his mother had any capacity for maintenance, or even noticed when things went wrong. One day, a very strong wind knocked a large tree limb down on the roof, causing major damage and a bad leak. They just left it there to rot. As a social service, one of the local fraternities would come by from time to time and take the mother out for groceries and such. One day, I came to work on the Oracle while Richard and his mother were at home. As I puttered along, all of a sudden they started yelling at each other. Richard would scream for a while, then his mother would take her turn. It was very embarrassing to overhear this severe domestic turmoil. I dropped something, and the noise must have reminded them I was there. The quarrel stopped cold. Then I realized the fraternity had come to pick up the mother before the quarrel started. Richard was all alone in the house. In another case of delusional pseudo-conversations, our brand new representative, Dick Armey, held a series of town hall meetings with his constituents. One was at the NTSU campus. I went accompanied by Rick Denton, my friend from physics class, who was Republican, but also rational, and nauseated by Armey. At this meeting, Armey showed us a short movie starring Lorne Greene singing the praises of the Strategic Defense Initiative. I suppose Greene's role in Battlestar Galactica gave him the credentials to evaluate the feasibility of Star Wars. Armey wanted to reduce funding for everything else and cut taxes for the rich, but then spend a trillion borrowed dollars on a weapon system that had no chance of working. The Republicans in the audience all wanted to talk about money and how they could keep more for themselves. Everyone else wanted to talk about ethics, good judgment, war and peace, education, and the environment. After all, Reagan was supporting the terrorist Contra forces in Nicaragua, and James Watt was Secretary of the Interior and had no interest in nature. Armey's response to my question was, "If you don't like what I'm doing, vote against me next election." That was his style of communicating with his constituents. It worked for 20 years until he could cash in and become a rich lobbyist due to the Republican K Street project he promoted. Trip to Denver. In early November, I was ready for a break and decided it would be a big adventure to drive my bug to visit Aconda. Once on the road, I thought it would be entertaining to try the journey on half a hit of my blotter, having never driven on acid before. Then a cold front blew in that created fog and ice from just outside Denton all the way to southern Colorado. With no heat in the car, I crawled into my sleeping bag and managed to operate the pedals through the bag. In the panhandle, Things were getting frigid, so I stopped in a store for a local newspaper, which I used to insulate the roof and plug the larger leaks, apologizing to the storekeeper for not reading it. I took Highway 287, a sizable road that goes from Fort Worth to Denver. But as the day progressed, I noticed that the road got somewhat smaller, from a divided highway to a three-lane. Then it shrank to a two-lane, then to a single lane, then to a rutted dirt track heading into a farmer's field. The changes seemed gradual and mysterious. I knew that 287 never got down to dirt. After all, I'd taken it to Montana with Randy. Evidently, half a hit was plenty while trying to navigate, even when there weren't any turns. I asked locals for directions and got back on the main drag. It was 7 p.m. and after dark when I got into Denver, with bumper-to-bumper traffic moving about as fast as my car would go. I was on the interstate and wondering when my turnoff would come when suddenly the engine died. I shifted to neutral and spun the wheel to cross two lanes of traffic to get off the road. Thankfully, no one was in the way, and much like when my engine threw a rod in 1977, there was an exit ramp at exactly the right spot. I pulled off the highway and onto the shoulder with the last remaining momentum. Physics, along with cosmic coincidence control, was on my side. I was very glad to have had the sharpened reflexes and acute awareness that LSD can provide in a pinch. I called my sister from a nearby hotel and got a tow to a shop that fixed the problem without too much fuss. We had a good visit, but I noticed that she had some medical problems and had gained a great deal of weight. This, along with panic attacks, ended her stage career. She worked at a frame shop and seemed to have given up on making some larger contribution. 1986. I cultivate vascular definition. One part of the Oracle was an assembly similar to electromagnets that had to be surrounded by a sphere at least 2 inches thick of graphite with a particular conductivity. I bought two large blocks of graphite for $1,000 and set to work hollowing out hemispheres about 14 inches across. At first, I took it to a school workshop, but in short order, the whole place was darkened by graphite dust, and I was persona non grata. Looking like a coal miner, I took the blocks back to Richard's garage and started drilling, chiseling, and wire brushing. Every day I would bathe and leave the tub solid black. Albert Most did interesting research on reversible monoamine oxidase inhibitors in conjunction with indole alkaloid psychedelics, which was a mouthful that caught my interest. The Amazonian Indians used DMT-containing plants, but used alone, that's a very brief experience. They discovered that by mixing that with an MAO inhibitor, the trip was far longer and more meaningful, and the herbs could be eaten instead of snorted or smoked. This was the mix used in ayahuasca ceremonies. I was especially interested in the ego-dissolving effects reported from the use of harmaline, whose first name was telepathine. This was legally obtainable as a powder made from wild rue, a Eurasian herb now growing as a common weed throughout the western states. There was a long list of medicinal uses, from treating depression to killing algae, bacteria, intestinal parasites, and molds. It is useful against malarial protozoa and is being researched as a cancer treatment. I had an account with a biological supply company from my mushroom work and bought some Harmala powder. As this was an experiment, Rodan was with me to help out in case of mishap, unlike my usual solo trips. I did a third of a gram of Harmala powder, then about an hour later did three hits of blotter. I knew right away this would be intense. Sitting on my bed, I realized I had to either let go and melt, or I would burn to a crisp, so I resolved to go ahead and melt. The top of my body from my waist up gently exploded. I looked down and saw only my hips on down. The rest of me flowed down across the floor, up the walls, and over the ceiling, until the entire environment, including Rodin, was me. There was perfect safety, since I was everything. It was a direct spiritual experience. When I went outside, the ego-free state remained. I was the trees, the street, the stars, the works. I could feel a total clarity in my awareness, which had some basis in physiology. Usually, LSD is only active in a very small part of the brain. But now, it was firing everywhere, and on all cylinders. I could feel mild effects for about a month, which kept me from repeating this combination, although there was no impairment. Even I had to come down and go about the business of living in the world. Working on the Oracle was just as physical as growing mushrooms, and I was feeling exhausted. I got together with my good friend Dan Canales, who was well-trained in physical matters and owned a local gym. I joined and started working out, but it didn't seem to help. I was losing weight instead of gaining. So I went to my doctor with my complaints. Ankylosing spondylitis is a wasting disease, and in the normal progression of things, people get more and more emaciated, weak, and fatigued. To combat this and several diseases, they developed anabolic steroids. They weren't devised with sports in mind. So, he says, bend over, and gave me a shot of decadurabolin. My life changed immediately. I had an appetite. I went from 120 pounds to 145 pounds in 3 months. My strength quadrupled, and I had energy. The effect waned in 2 months, and he gave me another shot. When I worked out, instead of just getting sore and tired, I actually got stronger. When I got a bad cut, it would be completely healed in 2 days. It was amazing. I felt healthy for the first time in 9 years. This was a very clumsy way to do steroids, and after some research, I got my own supply and did cycles with very small amounts, much less than weightlifters use. I continued with these cycles for about a year. With so little body fat, when I flexed my muscles, they felt like wood. People thought I was a marathon runner. There was no avoiding the negative side effects, including sudden hair loss and emotional instability. So even though there were so many positive factors, I had to stop. It was hard to imagine the Buddha on steroids. My spiritual development had to come first. With regular weight training, I managed to keep up most of the strength and weight for several years. By the fall, I could give up having a health aid, which allowed me to leave Texas. One of my local hippie friends was a fellow named Peace. He had long black hair and a bushy beard, and that "I've had way too much booze" look in his eye. At his birthday party, he blew out the candles on his cake, and in the process, ignited his beard. Good thing I was there to put it out, as he did not notice. One evening after dark, I was walking toward town, and he drove by and stopped to give me a ride for a few blocks. Foolishly, I accepted. I commented on how his car was not keeping in the lane very well, and he said it wasn't the car, it was the whiskey. This concerned me, as I had several hits of acid in my pocket. Sure enough, a cop pulled up behind us and flashed his lights. Turns out one of our back lights wasn't working. Peace talked to the officer, who evidently didn't feel like more paperwork that night, and told us to fix the light and have a good evening. Whew! Later, Peace drew up a proposal for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing happiness for all citizens as a right. I pointed out to him the legal detail that anything that the government can allow, it can also deny and control. So it's better to leave some things out of the law. He didn't follow the argument, and moved with his girlfriend to camp, full-time, in Lafayette Park across from the White House. From there, he visited many congressmen with his proposal. This fellow was what our lawmakers associated with the effects of psychedelics, not understanding that his wastage was the result of a potent mixture of alcohol and insanity. Acid was just frosting on the crazy cake. My correspondence with Woodstock continued to make the Oracle work possible. He was an excellent person to know, very reliable and conscientious. And his blotter was superb. For those of you unfamiliar with the trade, LSD is incredibly powerful, with the standard dose being only 50 micrograms. In the lab, sometimes dressed in scuba gear, they dissolve the solid crystal in alcohol, then dip pages of ornately printed blotter paper into the solution and hang them to dry. This is very effective in distributing standard dosages in a stable and easily transported form. Each page is 1,000 hits, and I would usually buy a page or two at a time. Then I would divide the page into 10 sheets and send them out in the mail. Since it was just odorless paper, it was impossible for the post office to detect. That spring, Woodstock told me that he and a couple of friends were driving their old hearse across the country and would drive through southern Oklahoma. Could I meet them there? I said, sure. So I drove off in my Wonderbug. He said to meet them at an international house of pancakes at a certain shopping center. When I got near, I saw their hearse, but also a cop car, and they were being questioned. So I parked in the next lot over to survey the scene. After a little bit, I screwed up my courage, since, after all, I had nothing illegal with me, and walked over all friendly-like and said, "Hey, Woodstock, what's up?" He said, "Boy, am I glad to see you." The restaurant owner had called the cops when these strange hippies were loitering in the lot, and Woodstock told them he was waiting for me. So I told the cop, "Well, I was a little worried when I saw your car," and he laughed and took off. Now, you gotta figure, this is rural southern Oklahoma, and here is a hearse with the inside all tie-dyed and reeking from days of hash smoke, and three road-weary hippies quite the other side of clean. I was amazed that the cop was so relaxed after I showed up. Woodstock gave me a page of his finest. We had a meal at what was now the Intergalactic House of Fruitcakes, and went on our respective trips. That was the last time I saw him. In June, his sister Carla told me Woodstock had been in Acapulco wearing heavy turquoise and silver jewelry, and after visiting several bars in a rough part of town, was stabbed to death in the early morning hours. He was in Mexico to translate a book about Mexican Indians from Spanish into English. The Mexican police had no interest in solving the crime, preferring to fish for bribes. The murderers approached Woodstock's brother and offered the jewelry for a few dollars. He was 37 years old. Business continued with Carla. Summer road trip. Rainbow 1986 was in Pennsylvania. I had been spending a lot of time with my friends David and Sarah, and we decided to make a grand tour of parts north and east. David was from deep East Texas and had a profound drawl that made him sound, well, slow. But in fact, he was extremely intelligent and got superb grades in graduate school studying history. He had a terrible chronic back pain and was taking formidable daily doses of Vicodin and Valium, since that's all the doctors could do for him. Both David and Sarah were devoted deadheads and big fans of my blotter. David didn't quite grasp the spiritual implications, but Sarah was tuning in. They were planning on a move to Las Cruces, New Mexico, where David would study at NMSU. We got in their SUV and headed to the hills. They were big fans of caves, so we stopped at as many as we could find, including Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. They dosed for the tour, but I was afraid of claustrophobia. Very impressive. Also on the route was a Grateful Dead concert at Riverbend Music Center in Cincinnati. This was the second of the two rock concerts I have ever attended. I played designated driver, being the conservative sort, so I only did mescaline, while David and Sarah did several hits of blotter. A sweaty deadhead came up begging for water, and as I lent her my Bota bag, I wished I had a blowtorch to flame-sterilize the mouthpiece afterwards. My months with mushrooms battling contamination, as well as getting sick at rainbow gatherings, had left me cautious. Speakers were everywhere, and even with hefty plugs wedged in my ears, the volume was intense. Whenever I had to take the plugs out for a few seconds, the sound hit my ears like a fist. The crowd was the most interesting part of the concert. It was a real community that would be the envy of any musical group. I wished that I could make music for people like this, but I couldn't find a way to make music for anyone at all, and just had to let it go. There were few cops in sight. After dark, I did notice two sullen and hostile policemen walking angrily around the periphery of the happy and well-behaved crowd, who were clearly not following all the statutory regulations regarding consciousness. I wore my poncho of invisibility, which, oddly enough, seemed to work. On to the mountains of Pennsylvania and the rainbow gathering. It had rained for 3 weeks and was still raining as we drove up to Rainbow Parking. There's usually at least a 3-mile hike from the trailhead to the nearest part of a gathering site in order to keep out the alcohol. A little austerity works wonders, but it can be rough with both arthritis and mud. After so many feet on the trails, the muck was a foot or more deep. We pitched our tents in not necessarily the wisest places. By morning, David and Sarah had 6 inches of standing water in their tent. They told me they were leaving, and if I wanted a ride, to pack my stuff now. I'd seen enough and went with them. After visiting Dad and Anton in Peabody and Beverly, I flew back to Dallas from Boston, my only psychedelic flight, and went back to work on the Oracle. I had enough money to get a better car, if still not a good one. I bought Dan Canales' old Pinto station wagon for $900. Mechanics who serviced it were puzzled by various tubes to nowhere that seemed to proliferate around the engine, but it was a step up from the 1962 Bug. I sold the VW to a Rainbow Valley friend on easy terms with delayed payments that never happened. Made the mistake of signing over the title. A lot of my Denton friends were going downhill, and I was tired of the scene and ready to move. On coming back to my apartment from New England, I saw that my front window was covered in plywood. Under the delusion that I had stolen his girlfriend, an alcoholic friend threw a cinder block through the window and busted the taillights on my car. Adding insult to injury, he snapped the plastic bat off the baseball trophy on the hood. And in other news, a drunken hippie came to my apartment in the early morning hours, pounded on the door, and yelled that he wanted to buy a hit of acid. This was sure to wake up the other people living in the same house. Besides, he knew there was a 100-hit minimum. An artist friend who was on speed and coke thought that the little white specks of dirt in his apartment were alive and crawling under his skin, and he did his best to convince me. Then there was a local schizophrenic deep in his cups who thought he had worked for the CIA. One of his many assignments was to destroy a Russian missile base in the Aleutians by riding a female orca that he controlled with a giant dildo. But CIA agents would periodically wipe his memory clean by pulling over in their van and putting electrodes onto his tongue wired to their car battery. Or so he claimed. He was pestering me to teach him how to manufacture acid, even though I insisted that he forget about it and please go get therapy. This was all highly uncomfortable and dangerous. Not everyone was doing psychedelics for spiritual uplift and enlightenment and avoiding other drugs as I did. I couldn't inspire a change in attitude, since I had my own long list of problems and character flaws. Besides, to do my Oracle experiment properly, I needed a different location, and so I started looking for a new home far away. My favorite magic elixir was the combination of mushrooms and K, although I only did that a few times. Once was during this summer, when I camped with two friends on the shore of a lake in southern Oklahoma. After nightfall, the motorboats went home and all was peaceful. I pitched my tent and ate 6 grams of dried mushrooms. As I was acclimated to such things, it was not so easy to tell if I was off or not, unless I looked up at the sky and saw that it flattened out and was doing the usual display of northern lights no one else could see. About an hour into the shrooms, I retired to my little dome and did the ketamine. 10 minutes later, there was a bulge in the continuum over my head. Out of this bulge emerged a probe with various small tentacles at the tip, which reached down and attached to the middle of my forehead. I was sucked out the top of my head while some other being took over my body, and I got a tour of the galaxy. At the time, I thought that was it, and somebody else would have to deal with my arthritis from then on. But eventually I came back and shooed away whomever it was and reintegrated into my monkey suit. Another day in the life. There were many like that. I went out to Las Cruces with David and Sarah and liked what I saw. The desert was quite a remarkable place. We drove to Carlsbad Caverns and dosed with blotter just before going in. The woman working for the Park Service as a ranger saw us and knew exactly what was up, since she was a deadhead herself. Carlsbad is an amazing place to trip, because the cave is already psychedelic. The roof looks the same as the floor. It comes pre-melted, and everything has a fractal quality of scale invariance. We also went to the Guadalupe Mountains in West Texas and White Sands during a clear night with a full moon. Seemed like time to plot a move. I bought an old 18-foot camping trailer and brought it over to the Earnharts. With some friends helping, I stripped out the inside and adapted it to use with my project. I drilled 6-inch holes in the floor so the optical resonator could mount directly on the ground. I also bought a small flatbed trailer for the Orgone box. Leaving Denton for Good, Part 5. In September, I rented a U-Haul truck, loaded up my camping trailer, stacked the Orgone box sides on my flatbed, and with the assistance of David, Sarah, and 2 other friends, headed west to Las Cruces. This was quite the dramatic change of scene. Now I was in Sirius Desert, where it rained 8 inches that year. In Denton, I'd seen it rain that much in an afternoon. I bought an old, run-down, single-wide trailer and stashed my Orgone box in David and Sarah's backyard. Las Cruces is 50 miles north of El Paso, which is just across the Rio Grande from Juarez. Naturally, our first order of business was to get some ketamine, as I had run out. David and I walked over the bridge to Mexico and hailed a taxi. Usually, such a driver will advise his passengers as to the merits and locations of various donkey shows, even if they don't show any interest in that kind of entertainment. But we had a special request. Could he help us find a veterinarian? Veterinary ketamine was the same purity and in a more convenient concentration than that bottled for humans. He took us to a small shop, and we went in and rang the bell for service. A drowsy, middle-aged fellow in a T-shirt came out to the counter, and with the help of our driver, we asked him if he could get us some K. We arranged for him to buy it in El Paso, where he got his medicines, and we would get it from him there. That way, everything was nominally legal, and there was no smuggling. We gave him a couple of $100, crossed our fingers, and went back to El Paso to wait at our designated spot. Sure enough, a couple of hours later, our new friend came over to us with a paper bag with two cartons, each with 10 1-gram bottles. David and I were set. A few months later, David and I ran low and returned to the same shop. The owner had returned from a vacation to parts south and had a nice shirt on this time. He was delighted to see us, and we repeated the transaction. That kind of money for him was a big deal. Out of curiosity, I went of a Sunday morning to the local Unitarian Universalist church. The minister was shared with other congregations, and from his late model white Cadillac, he clearly didn't need the income. One parishioner was astronomer Clyde Tombaugh, then 80 years old, and the discoverer of Pluto, the largest Kuiper belt object. The Tombaugh belt was considerably north of his equator. He was a formidably careful and objective observer, and used his skills during 3 observations of UFOs near Las Cruces and White Sands. The Big Bang and other newfangled ideas were unacceptable, as the old-time steady-state cosmology was good enough for him. I also met Jerry and Pat Cole, both quite convinced in their atheism, which made for many interesting conversations. Jerry was recently retired from nuclear weapons work. They were friendly and generous, and I got to know them and their family quite well. When I visited New Mexico State University, I saw that the conductor of the Las Cruces Symphony based there was Mariana Gabi, who had been in my conducting class with Anshul Brusilov. I knew that she was a good conductor, so it was with high hopes that I submitted a couple of scores for her consideration. Some orchestra members would get together at one of their apartments after rehearsals, so I asked Mariana if I could tag along and get acquainted. There were teachers and students there. All of the teachers had trained at major conservatories. The conversation veered into job prospects for graduates, a subject about which I had considerable bitterness. I pointed out the low rate of employment with Eastman graduates. The last classmate I'd met was an excellent horn player in a Boston subway on the way to his job in a stockbroker's office. How is he to find work when there are 400 hornists graduating each year for 3 jobs? The students didn't believe me, and the teachers were infuriated. Their jobs depended on students believing that music degrees from NMSU were tickets to music careers. A few days later, I asked Mariana if I could come again to another orchestral social event, and she almost slapped me. However true my words were, they ensured I would have no more contact with local musicians. I had channeling sessions with Rodin in 1986, but these were not as clear as those with Terence 4 years previously. I was worried about needing a mid-course correction. There was no fundamental instrument analogous to a voltmeter or ammeter to measure the energy I was working with, and so I had no way to tell if my various components and connections were functional. The whole oracle itself was the simplest mechanical detector for prana, which was an enormous impediment. I looked around for people to work with in guided meditations and tried several local friends, but nothing worked out. One woman I tried this with had several cats, all of whom were crazy in love with her, and I took one of her kittens home. It was wonderful to have Fred Feline in my humble abode. Gerald Blow and Carolyn came by from Denton and took a picture of Fred licking the inside of my nostrils. I grew tired of my run-down and cramped trailer park. After a couple of months, I moved a few blocks away to a more run-down but roomier trailer slum where I could put my camping trailer and Oregon box next to my single-wide house trailer. I left Fred in the house trailer as it was towed to the new location. When I got there, I saw the door had sprung open and the kitten was gone, never to be seen again. Distraught, I went to the animal shelter and got a small tortoiseshell female cat who had lived on the streets for some time. Mauser Wowser would be my dear friend and the closest thing I've ever had to my own family for the next 4 years. She taught me a great deal about love and playfulness and trust and how to chew a rabbit in two with one bite. But I wasn't letting her near my stash of cat anesthetic. With my new digs next to the irrigation canal, my progress on the oracle stalled. I could make bits and pieces, but this rough neighborhood was not the location to put it together and turn it on. Besides, I had a break-in where thieves stole electronics from the camping trailer, requiring installation of thick metal bars over the windows. That was taken care of by one of the neighbors I'd befriended, whose obese wife was a witch. And I mean seriously obese, and seriously a witch. Their whole trailer was tricked out with druid and wicca and whatnot gewgaws. She tried some of my vitamin K and predictably had a rather dark experience. The husband complained about not having many friends, and I didn't have the heart to clue him in to how easy it was to be scared off by the wife dressed in black with black lipstick and black nail polish and satanic jewelry and tattoos. While contemplating my next step, I decided to write a little more music. So in early 1987, I looked around for an upright piano. Back in Bruce Hall days, in about 1976, one of my friends was the largest guy in the dorm, who had a huge van and a massive dog. Turns out his family business was a piano shop in Las Cruces, and they were all behemoths. Handy in that trade. So now I had a piano in my trailer and started work on a completely new version of the Variations on the Grosse Fugue, this time for 5 synthesizers. It took almost 3 months, finishing on March 22nd. During those months, I was tripping every other day. At the end, I did ketamine once a day for a week and realized this was not a good idea. From then on, I cut way back until I did it only a few times a year. However, I did have another untested frontier. At that time, nitrous oxide was still legal, and I saw an ad for a firm in Houston that sold 60-pound tanks. That's a tank over 5 feet tall, holding 550 cubic feet of gas. Although I had never done nitrous before, I sent off a check, and sure enough, one day I got a call from my private postal center saying, "Mr. Robinson, your gas has arrived." Yippee! So down I went to pick it up. Then I screwed on a quick-release fitting and got a stainless ball valve and a couple of very robust 4-foot-diameter weather balloons. Now I could snap on the valve, throw the lever, and fill the weather balloon in short order. That's enough gas for an entire Mae West movie. I learned that if done for more than about an hour, there's a hangover, so I took it easy. There are plenty of ways to hurt yourself with nitrous if it's done without regard to asphyxiation. Yes, oxygen is required for life as we know it. Or gas laws. Suck directly on a tank, and you can freeze your lungs. But I knew enough about biology and physics to stay safe. Nitrous was fun, but not as deep and rewarding as other methods. I had come close to learning everything I could from psychedelics, which was a lot. This left me with all the things I needed to deal with that no magic elixir could cure. There was no escaping the fundamental reality that whatever goes up must come down. Even with completely drug-free traditional yogic methods that lead to extremely high states, the same principle applies. The real progress in spiritual life is done down here in the dirt, in the day-to-day mundane awareness we signed up for in the first place. Sometimes you need to visit Technicolor Oz quite a few times before realizing there's no place like Om, even if it's in black and white. I had been more of a yo-yo than a yogi, and so I cut way back on tripping. Life back on Earth. Anton told me he'd set up something called New York Guarantee and Trust, based in Amsterdam with his financial friends, and through some sort of machination, it had a substantial paper worth that could turn into actual cash any day. It was being worked over by some European banks and teams of lawyers. If the payday came, I would be able to set up the Oracle in style with a real machine shop and employees. So I started looking around for a good site. I visited Silver City, a delightful small town with a beautiful climate in the mountains west of Las Cruces, and hobnobbed with the Chamber of Commerce, touring possible places to rent. Anton continued to anticipate many millions of dollars from this deal for the next 10 years, always any day now. After a while, I just said, "Sure, Anton," and no longer embarrassed myself by considering it possible. I continued my weight training at a local gym, owned by a bald fellow who clearly had bulked up way too much with steroids. There was a bank of tall, thin metal lockers against one wall and back with a bench in front of it. And I opened up one to change my clothes. On getting up from the bench, I pulled on the open door and the entire bank of lockers tipped over toward me. I immediately got into my locker as it fell over onto the bench. Had I not done that, or had the door closed, the lockers surely would have killed me. As it was, I just had a scratch on my knee and a bad scare. After that, they bolted the lockers to the wall. In April 1987, I flew to the San Francisco airport to visit Carla, who lived in Marin County, as had Woodstock. My only glimpse of the city and the bay was from the car as we drove over the Golden Gate Bridge, which my father saw being built. I stayed a week getting to know some of the characters in that peculiar neck of the woods. One fellow was the longtime editor of a local magazine. He had taken a hit of acid every day for the last 7 years and seemed perfectly fine to me. Another man had several amber necklaces, some with enormous beads, which I complimented. Turns out he worshipped amber, thought amber was the guide to higher reality, and simply would not talk about anything else. Amber was his entire life and the center of his constant devotion. He was even ambidextrous. Welcome to California. Carlo rented a beautiful home surrounded by lush vegetation, tall trees, and blooming flowers. It was a relief after my stay in the desert. She had hummingbird feeders out on the yard. The large sliding glass doors were open one sunny afternoon, and I heard a thumping by the kitchen sink, which was in front of a large picture window. This was a female hummingbird who had flown in and was trying to get out. I managed to gather her in my hands and gently carried her outside. When I opened up my hands, zip! Off she went at 70 miles an hour. About 10 minutes later, I heard the same sound from the same place. The bird was back and trying to get out again. This time she was very tired, and when I picked her up, she collapsed in my palms. I took her this time directly to the feeder. I had to lift up her beak and place it into the feeding hole so she could drink some sugar water. When I did this, a male hummingbird flew to another hole on the feeder, inches from my hands. He knew he could trust me. After a few minutes, she'd finished drinking. I opened my hands, and zip! Off she went at 70 miles an hour into the top of the tallest trees. Marin County was certainly gorgeous, and it was not at all unusual to be a hippie there. Ram Dass lived just down the street in San Anselmo. But lots of people were chasing after a spot in paradise, tired of the places they had already ruined. Ram Dass often quoted the third Zen patriarch who said, "The great way is easy for those who have no preferences." Deciding where to live is a big preference. Besides, the California prisons were among the most psychotic and dangerous in the nation. Risking arrest there was even more terrifying than what I had become accustomed to. My parents left California in the late 1940s because it was getting too crowded and expensive, and it made sense to me. I enjoyed my week getting to know Carla and seeing the sights, but had no inclination to move to the Pacific Coast. The more I knew David, the more I appreciated the toll his addiction to Valium and Vicodin was taking on his life. He was frequently severely depressed to the point of threatening suicide, although frequently that seemed like a way to win arguments and get attention. He and Sarah both grew pot plants in their closet and tired of Las Cruces, so they left to find another home somewhere in North Texas. When they left, my own perspective changed, and I saw that southern New Mexico really wasn't the right place for me. I needed somewhere with a rich culture where I had a chance to contribute. Las Cruces jobs were mostly either military or agricultural, which didn't make for much classical music, Eastern religions, or exotic physics. Now, if I had just tried northern New Mexico, where they have all of that, but the cold and the expense scared me off. One day at the local food store in Las Cruces, I met Gordon Solberg, who is a beekeeper and ex-planetary astronomer who used to be an expert in weather on Jupiter. After becoming hippified in the peak years of the Nixon administration, he set up shop near Radium Springs on the Rio Grande. I visited his micro-farm, and we paddled for an afternoon down the river in his canoe. He had the most eco-friendly way of life I'd seen. His home was solar-heated and very cozy. This was the kind of grounded living that made a lot of sense to me, but that I couldn't quite manage. If I had the strength, beekeeping would be a choice occupation, but there's a lot of lifting involved, beyond my capacity, even with the anti-inflammatory bee stings. Gordon and wife Laura run Sun Mountain Honey, and today Gordon fills his internet blogs with terrific radical leftist and apocalyptic rants, just as I would if I weren't busy ranting right here. When you live like they do, there's no avoiding being in tune with nature and seeing how it suffers from our abuse. Big Summer Voyage. I saw that a little boat could connect me not only with the outdoors and physical activity, but with very interesting people and unexpected environments as well. With increased strength, mobility, and endurance, I was ready for some physical adventure. The Oracle project was stalled, and business was thriving, so with my extremely frugal living, I had a decent pile of cash saved up. Years ago, during my Escape to the Sea in books, I read Hans Lindemann's dramatic account of crossing the Atlantic in a Klepper folding kayak. This was a boat I could sail or paddle for an afternoon or a week on rivers or lakes or the ocean, and it fit in a couple of canvas bags. I got in touch with Eric Stiller up at the Manhattan Clipper USA office, and they shipped me a boat with a sailing rig. It was a masterpiece of engineering. I went to work making outriggers with floats made of a truck inner tube I'd sliced and sealed, and aluminum tubing for the crossarms. When all was ready, I stashed 3,000 hits in a waterproof bag and took off for the long drive to New England on June 20th. While traveling, I'd check my phone messages and send off letters as needed to fill orders. But I didn't go directly to New England. I'd last seen Dorothy in early 1983, when she took a break from the Wisconsin winter and family to party hardy in Denton. Nothing like a few years in the temple scene to make you shake your booty, now, is there? She and her husband Arjuna, 5-year-old daughter, and 2-year-old son moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. The Rainbow Gathering was going to be in western North Carolina, so I thought it would be quite the treat to introduce them to the tribe and let them introduce me to a new part of the country. The results changed all of our lives. We drove out to the Joyce Kilmer National Forest and trekked into the gathering. Dorothy hadn't tripped since before she joined the ISKCON Temple and was out of practice. After we had our camp all set up, she decided to make a day of it by wearing multiple layers of colorful saris and such, plus her expensive camera and a bag of this and that. I told her to pack as lightly as possible, since I'd end up lugging her gear, but this was not in her nature. So she ate the blotter and we set out. Sure enough, she started to peel off the layers, handing me her belongings and garb as we went along. Soon I had my arms full of her stuff, and she was naked, smeared with mud by other rainbow hippies. I stashed her belongings out of sight and assumed she'd be just fine. She found a new extended family here and went to as many gatherings as she could from then on. Among the hippie brethren, she now went by Rainbow Weaver. After the gathering, we returned to Charlotte and recovered from the usual rainbow dysentery, which was particularly virulent this year. While there, I did a channeling session with Rainbow that went extremely well and helped me plot my next move to North Carolina. This included a prayer from her spiritual guide that I started saying twice a day. I then continued on my way northeast, following the scenic route through the mountains so as to break down in the hills of rural western Maryland. The mechanics in Versailles, which the locals call Versailles, wondered how my car got so far. But then it was fixed, and after a visit with Paul, who was building a large circular home of his own design in the woods, and a stop by the Klepper office in Manhattan, I went on to Dad and Anton in Massachusetts. I'd been talking with Anton about how he could help fund my research, and he said he'd found a way. There was this guy named Wardell who had the inside scoop on a great stock investment, and he and his sister were both putting everything they could afford into it. So I said, okay, and put $2,000 of my acid revenue into the pot, plus Anton's brokerage fee. As I was about to leave his upstairs with the rents abode, he mentioned, and I get half your profits. I said, no damn way, and he backed off. 2 or 3 days later, he told me the stock was frozen, could not be sold, and we'd lost the money. Now, with the wonders of the internet, I see that James Wardell had been convicted of stock fraud in 1977 with a prior in 1972 and was about to be indicted again just before he died. The loss was a valuable lesson. It got me thinking about the ethics of the stock market and capitalism in general. Why did Anton and his financial industry cohorts like dictators? Anton even advocated a return to monarchy, although I pointed out it took over a century of struggle and millions of lives to get rid of it. Free markets allocate power according to money, which is incompatible with any true democracy. My spiritual path was showing me in vivid terms the unity of our awareness and the illusion of separation. So why would I sell someone a stock if I thought it was go down? Every transaction seemed to be a result of thinking the other person was someone else. No wonder so many brokers were living on cocaine, the ultimate ego drug. This was my first and last stock purchase. After a trial paddle with Anton in Beverly Harbor, we drove to Manchester, just south of Gloucester and Cape Ann. There we assembled and packed my boat with camping gear, food and water, outriggers, sail, and a 1.5 horsepower outboard motor. And don't forget the 3,000 hits way up in the bow. The whole thing loaded was at least 250 pounds. Destination, Ferry Beach and Saco, Maine, about 100 miles away. After I launched, Anton drove my car back to his house to await my return. To avoid rounding the outside of Cape Ann, I took the canal through Gloucester. There, rich jerks in huge motorboats tested my kayak with their towering wakes that reflected off the banks. It was reassuring to see that I could bounce back after complete submergence. I camped for the first night on the northern end of the canal. The next day was a wild 30-mile trip to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I found a suitable gravel spit for my tent. The next day was blowing about 20 knots in my face inside the harbor. I made an attempt to fight it, but after getting out of the sheltered water, I thought better and went back to my gravel spit to wait it out. My gaff sloop rig and modest leeboards were not extremely efficient going to windward against a breaking chop. Next day, conditions were still rough, but the wind was favorable, and off I went. I ventured about 4 miles off the coast until I could see the land only from the tops of the 8-foot waves. Passing keelboats appeared hardly to notice how rough things were, just lowering their headsails, but for me, it was pretty damn dramatic under my reefed main. Lunch was crackers and a can of sardines, made possible by steering with my feet. In case of bailing or bowel movement, I had a handy bedpan, quite a luxury for a kayak trip. By about 6 p.m., I saw my destination, Kennebunkport Harbor, through my monocular. Cruising safely to one side of the Bush family compound, I docked about an hour later after another 30-mile, 11-hour day. When I got on land, my first goal was to find a camping store, since my stove broke on the first night. However, all the shops appeared to have only stuffed animals and mass-produced big-eye clown paintings on velvet. No wonder the Bushes felt so much at home here. I asked a cop if there was any place near I could get a stove and where there might be a place to camp. He looked at me all suited up in my kayak foul-weather gear and face crusted with salt and said, "You're the first real person I've talked to all day." He said there wasn't anything but tourist crap in town. I was out of luck with the stove, but he'd drive me the short distance to campground. So that's where I pitched my tent for the night. The next day was moderate and calm in the afternoon, so I motored into Saco Bay and landed at Ferry Beach in the afternoon. Mom and Burns were in charge of the music programs, and Akonda was visiting. She was rather put off by my doing something so physical, and thought it was some kind of sports stunt. She didn't understand the magic and the spiritual aspect until I took her out for an afternoon paddle back in Beverly Harbor. There she saw the harmony of the elements at play, the play of light on the water, the rhythm of the waves, and how entrancing it can be. Messing about in boats can be a legitimate spiritual path. She got the drift, although at the price of very sore arms and shoulders the next few days. I was completely exhausted, even after over a year of weight training with steroid therapy and being stronger than I'd ever been. I still had severe arthritis, and this was beyond what my body could handle. I got on the phone and bought Bacchus a plane ticket so he could fill the front seat. Even with no camping gear, sailing a 2-seat kayak alone is a big job. And with way too much gear, it's formidable for a strong, healthy man. It didn't matter that Bacchus wasn't experienced on the water. He was healthy, centered, and a good traveling companion. When he arrived, we headed for Maine and did a series of day trips, which was much more practical than an extended cruise. The Maine coast is heavily populated, and it's a real challenge to find places to land and camp. One day, we launched in Camden and saw coming into the harbor a 50-foot schooner of delightful proportions, a spoon-bowed John Alden design. This was Daphne, launched in 1929 and owned by Howard Nash, then in his 70s. He'd been cruising in Daphne since the 40s, based in Lobster Cove on Cape Ann. He and his young crew welcomed us aboard. Howard's father was 100 years old. The old man went missing for 3 days driving back to Massachusetts. Turns out, he hooked up with a retired teacher he met on the way. Sailing keeps you young. But maintenance makes you age, and with a wooden boat of this size, the work is constant and daunting. Howard called this condition rotational rot. He'd go around the boat replacing sections of decking each year, and by the time he got back to where he started, it needed replacing again. Towards the end of the day, after the wind died, we saw a curious contraption entering the harbor using a minute outboard motor. My jaw dropped, and I told Bacchus, "That's a proa." I'd never seen one, because there were only two on the East Coast. This was Cowrie, designed and built by Russell Brown, son of Jim Brown, a well-known designer of trimarans. Proas were invented by Polynesians and have one long, thin hull and a smaller hull always kept to windward. This means that when tacking, the boat has to exchange bow for stern, quite an intricate maneuver. We came aboard and got the grand tour. There was a picture of Cowrie offshore doing 20 knots hanging on the wall. In 2000, Russ, with crewman Steve Callahan, sailed his next proa, Jezero, from San Francisco to the Marquesas Islands and then alone to Australia and New Zealand. A little south of Camden is Georgetown Island. Bacchus had a friend whose mother I'll call Theodora, ran one of the finest bed and breakfasts on the Maine coast, on a spectacular site overlooking an inlet to a bay. We were living in style now, but I had to be on my best behavior. Theodora was an enthusiastic evangelical Christian and believed that the King James Bible was the inerrant word of God. None of that Hebrew or Greek stuff would cut it. She was convinced that when Madonna gave a concert in Baghdad, as she was scheduled to do soon, it would signal the beginning of the end of the world and the second coming of Christ. Evidently, rock and roll is uncommonly influential. Our conversation strayed to the drug war, and she said that anyone caught dealing acid should be castrated and then slowly tortured to death. I crossed my legs and ate cautiously. Bacchus and I launched the clipper to paddle out into the bay, which is exposed to the open ocean to the south. We headed out with the tide from the shelter of the harbor. Bacchus had not been in open water yet, and the wind was lively and from the south. When we got into a little chop, he asked how high the waves were, and I said, "About a foot." Next time he asked, it was with a touch more concern, and I said, 2 feet. When the waves hid the horizon, I said, 3 feet. Finally, when we were in open water, we got into 6 to 8 footers, and Bacchus was duly impressed. It was not a good idea to capsize, as the water temperature was around 45 degrees.